KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
As a little girl growing up in Chippewa Falls, I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world.
Democrats pulled off a win in a Wisconsin judicial race and cut into Republican margins in two Florida House races.
It's Wednesday, April 2nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. For more than 25 hours, Democratic New Jersey Senator Cory Booker held the Senate floor condemning Trump administration policies.
This is a moral moment that more Americans need to stand up and say enough is enough.
I speak with Senator Booker about his historic speech.
Also, there's so much uncertainty in the economy right now. What does that mean for people looking to buy a house?
And we remember actor Val Kilmer, who died yesterday at 65 years old.
I am a lizard king. I can do anything.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump using the White House Rose Garden as a backdrop and holding a large chart unveiled, retaliatory tariffs that will hit just about every country in the world. With a baseline of 10%, the tariffs in some cases are as high as 50%. NPR's Tamara Keith says economists already expect U.S. consumers to bear some of the costs.
Most economists warn that these tariffs will ultimately hike consumer prices. Importers in the U.S. pay them, not foreign countries, and they'll pass them on to Americans buying the products. And some countries are already threatening retaliation that could hit farmers and other key U.S. industries that rely on exports.
But Trump appears to be undeterred by critics, putting the highest tariffs on dozens of nations that run large trade surpluses with the U.S. Separately, a 25% tariff on imported cars and parts coming into the U.S. goes into effect after midnight. Elon Musk's Doge Group is expected to continue operating through the summer, though it's increasingly looking like it may continue its work without the billionaire entrepreneur. Musk is now saying he could be done with his work at the entity he helped create in the near future. Trump has said Musk will go back to running his companies and Doge will end at some point. Those discussions were even being held before a major setback for the administration this week, voters rejecting a Wisconsin State Supreme Court candidate despite backing from the administration and millions spent by Musk personally on the race. At least a dozen Israeli airstrikes hit Syria late Wednesday. The Israeli military says it targeted Syria's military capabilities, but Syrian state media says there have been civilian casualties. More from NPR's Lauren Frayer.
Footage shared on social media shows explosions lighting up the sky over the Syrian city of Hama. Israel says it struck military infrastructure there, as well as an airbase in Homs and a scientific building in the capital, Damascus. State media say dozens of Israeli military vehicles also made an incursion deeper into southern Syria. Israel used to attack often under Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who allowed Iran to transfer weapons through this country. But that arms route was cut off with Assad's ouster late last year. Syria's new government has not attacked Israel and says it does not plan to. But Israel has sought to disarm it nonetheless, with hundreds of air and artillery strikes in recent months. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, Damascus.
It's not clear how serious an offer it is, but Amazon is reported to have put in a bid to buy TikTok. Meanwhile, there are also other offers, apparently, with a U.S. ban on the platform set to take effect this weekend. A Trump administration official not authorized to comment publicly said the offer came in a letter to Vice President J.D. Vance and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Latest bid comes as President Trump was slated to meet with officials at the White House today. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 235 points. The Nasdaq rose 151 points. This is NPR. China has now wrapped up military drills in the Taiwan Strait. That area separates the self-governing island democracy from mainland China and is a crucial zone for international trade. Taiwan's military says it closely monitored the drills. Taiwan reported 76 Chinese military aircraft and 19 naval or government ships entering the waters and airspace near the island. Actor Val Kilmer has died. He starred in such movies as Top Gun, Willow, and Batman Forever in the 80s and 90s. As NPR's Neda Ulbi reports, Kilmer died Tuesday in Los Angeles. He was 65 years old.
Val Kilmer brought zest and swagger to movies ranging from 1991's The Doors, where he played rock star Jim Morrison, to 1993's True Romance, where Kilmer played rock star Elvis Presley, mentoring the movie's hero from beyond the grave.
I like you, Clarice. always have. Always will.
Kilmer also starred in such movies as Tombstone, Heat, and The Saint. He returned to the role of Iceman in 2022's Top Gun Maverick, even after a throat cancer diagnosis. But Val Kilmer died of pneumonia, according to the Associated Press. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
NASA's Webb Telescope has captured a new picture of an asteroid that caused something of a stir earlier this year, discovered late last year. Astronomers estimated there was a 3% chance the asteroid known as 2024 YR4 could smack into the Earth in 2032. Where additional observations led scientists to push that chance to near zero, with a slight chance it could hit the moon. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Democrats have not had a lot of good news since Donald Trump returned to the White House, but elections in Wisconsin and Florida last night are giving them some glimmers of hope and Republicans some cause for concern. To help us unpack all of this, NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi there.
Hey there.
So Democrats won a race in Wisconsin. They lost two in Florida. So how much hope could Democrats really take away from what happened last night?
Well, the candidate that Democrats endorsed in the Wisconsin judicial race, Susan Crawford, won by 10 points. And that's in a state that went for Trump by a point in 2024. You know, Republicans did win the two special elections for congressional seats in Florida, but these are very conservative districts. And Democrats cut into the margins there pretty significantly. Margins are what matter in special elections. You know, the party that consistently overperforms in them leading up to midterms usually does pretty well in them. You know, that's all big for a party like Democrats that have been reeling, really, since Trump came into office. Democrats have seen their lowest favorability ratings ever in recent polling in the 20s. So they'll take what they can get right now. And importantly, Wisconsin was something of a rejection of Elon Musk.
Yeah, and to that point, Musk, who has, of course, been at Trump's right hand since he was sworn in, he played a big role in this race. What has the reaction been like today?
Yeah, Trump ignored it on social media. Musk himself was clearly peeved. He said he never really expected to win and that a voter ID measure that was passed was really the important thing. Hard to believe, really, though, because he spent $20 million on the race. And when he went to the state, I mean, he went there to promote the conservative candidate before the election, he said that the, quote, entire destiny of humanity could rest on the judicial race. Talk about raising the stakes.
Right.
So I think he cared a little bit about winning this race. And we're now seeing some local Republican officials publicly questioning whether it was a good idea for Musk to play in the race at all. For Democrats, few things have upset them more since Trump became president than all the haphazard firings and cuts to the federal government that Musk has led with DOGE, his informal Department of Government Efficiency. Polls have shown Musk and DOGE to be unpopular, and this Wisconsin race was affirmation of that for Democrats, that they feel like they can run against what he's been doing. And there are probably lots of Republicans in Congress privately pretty happy about what happened in Wisconsin.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, they've been facing a lot of tough questions from constituents at town halls. So much of it has been about DOGE. I'm sure lots of them would be thrilled to see Musk take a step back and be less of a face of Trump's agenda, especially since he's also been out there calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme and saying that entitlements probably have to be cut. Those are the kinds of things that are political kryptonite normally, and they really run contrary to Trump's own messaging. A lot of people really do support the idea of cutting the federal government, but in a more measured and targeted way.
Is there any evidence to suggest that Trump is going to break with Musk?
Well, Musk's appointment already has a rough end date. The special government consultant role he has expires after about 130 days, which would be the end of next month. Reading the tea leaves here, that may stick because considering, you know, Musk has adjusted his public language about the cuts. He's gone from parading on the stage with a chainsaw to saying that the team is simply aiming for targeted cuts. Wisconsin makes it that much easier for Trump to cut ties with Musk and say that that was the plan all along, if that's what he winds up deciding to do.
I'm wondering if there is a lesson that Democrats can learn here about what kind of message led to results like those we saw in those elections last night and whether this can be replicated.
Well, I think, you know, this is less about a framing of progressive versus moderate or center versus left, which we hear all the time, as opposed to realizing these off-year elections are about, in many ways, firing up your base of voters. And right now, Democratic voters want people they think are going to fight for their morals and for their values. So it's really about fighting versus acquiescence. And Wisconsin Democrats will tell you that their candidates did just that, whether it was Susan Crawford, you know, the judicial candidate standing up for abortion rights, or the state school superintendent who won her election fighting for against the closure of the Department of Education. It's especially important in midterm elections when turnout is lower than presidentials. And again, energy is most important.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You got it.
This afternoon, President Trump announced new taxes on imported goods from a broad range of countries around the world. He's calling them reciprocal tariffs. Now, this isn't the first time that U.S. leaders have been so gung-ho about tariffs. Our colleagues over at The Indicator from Planet Money have put together a little history lesson. Here are NPR's Darian Woods and Adrian Ma.
You can roughly think of the history of U.S. tariff policy as falling into three distinct eras. So first would be the revenue era of tariff policy. It began back in the late 1780s when the U.S. was still a baby nation. Doug Irwin is a professor at Dartmouth College who's written lots of books on international trade.
So the second act passed by Congress was a tariff act. And that's because the most important problem that was facing the country was the government had no money. And of course, we were very long from having an income tax. So tariffs were sort of the only way of raising revenue for the federal government.
When a ship came into port carrying foreign tea or spices or whatever, you could stop them right there and say, if you want to unload that cargo, you have to pay Uncle Sam first.
But by the mid-1800s, around the time of the Civil War, Doug says this began to change.
So U.S. industry had begun to grow up during this period. Steel producers and others wanted to keep foreign steel and foreign textiles out of the U.S. market.
Tariff policy shifted from being about revenue to being about restriction.
In the ensuing years, this protectionist approach to trade policy grew and grew and grew until 1930, when it finally boiled over with an infamous piece of legislation known as the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act.
Now, initially the tariff was supposed to protect just U.S. farmers, but as it made its way around Congress, lawmakers said, "Ooh, I want a piece of that.
If you vote for my tariff, I'll vote for yours." And so things sort of spun out of control and the tariff levels went up quite a bit.
In the end, Congress raised tariffs on thousands of goods. And other countries saw this and were like, okay, you want to play that game? And a global trade war ensued.
By the late 1940s, policymakers looked back on that era of tariffs gone wild and they thought, well, that was a mistake. And this began a third era of U.S. tariff policy. Reciprocation.
In the era of reciprocation, countries said, okay, let's ratchet things down, let's put down the tariffs and work together to promote freer and fairer trade. And the biggest way this manifested was the World Trade Organization, basically a big trade club.
By the 1990s, the world had become increasingly globalized, but not all was blissful in the era of reciprocation. In recent decades, many Americans working manufacturing lost their jobs as their work was moved overseas. And this has paved the way for tariffs to make a comeback.
Luis Baldomero Quintana is a professor who teaches international trade at William & Mary. And his take on tariffs is similar to what most economists would probably tell you, which is they're generally not a good idea.
My first reaction is, who's going to pay for those tariffs? Tariffs are taxes, and someone pays for those taxes.
And in a lot of cases, who pays for it is American businesses and consumers.
Darian Woods,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
On any given day, there are hundreds of different exhibitions on view at the Smithsonian's many museums, but last week, the White House singled out one in an executive order, so NPR's Elizabeth Blair paid a visit to the Smithsonian American Art Museum to see that show about race and sculpture. The first work she encountered was a colorful, life-size sculpture by the artist Roberto Lugo.
His body is divided into different patterns. On the bottom, there's this purple, yellow, and white flag type design. On his torso, the colors are red, green, black, orange. He's kind of a hefty guy.
It's a very real body. I was 100 pounds heavier, and the reality is that, you know, being a person of color in America is very loaded.
Artist Roberto Lugo grew up in a poor neighborhood in Philadelphia.
Many of us grew up in food deserts, in places where obesity was very common because of the lack of quality of food. And so when I make a piece like this, I like to allow myself to be vulnerable and let it all out, because then everybody around you allows himself also to be vulnerable.
The White House executive order says the Smithsonian promotes narratives that are divisive. But Lugo says he wants his art to bring people of all backgrounds and political beliefs together, including white people.
I think for many people who support Trump, I think they feel disenfranchised and like their quality of life suffers because they're not given opportunities because of their race. I feel as if that should be a point where we connect with one another. That's exactly precisely how people of color feel.
The Shape of Power, stories of race and sculpture, spans three centuries up to the present day. There's a playful bronze statue from 1906 of a little girl gliding on one roller skate, her arms stretched out, squealing in delight and fear. The artist, Abastinia Saint-Léger Eberly, was known for depicting poor immigrants in her lower Manhattan neighborhood. The exhibition points out that at the time, the mostly Italian, Eastern European, and Jewish immigrants were not considered white. For visitor Jillian Vallad, who's black, that was
eye-opening. I think it's, you know, an opportunity to see another point of view.
Vallad says the Smithsonian tells stories that help people interrogate their own biases.
I think that's what you would want to do. Like, you would want to grow as a person and not, like, stay static.
The White House did not respond to a request for comment. The Shape of Power is on view at the Smithsonian American Art Museum through mid-September. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's spring, which means for sale signs are popping up in front of homes around the country. But with so much uncertainty in the economy, will this spring's housing market be hot or not? NPR personal finance correspondent Laurel Walmsley is here to give us the forecast. Hey, Laurel.
Hey, Ari.
So bottom line, is this a good time to buy a house?
Well, it's definitely not the cheapest time to buy a house. I mean, mortgage rates are about 6.6%, which is down a bit from where they were in January, but it's still pretty high. Meanwhile, median home prices are really high, having shot up 47% in the last 5 years. You know, in some parts of the country, the market has been sort of frozen. Last year was the slowest for existing home sales since 1995. But it's not that people don't want to buy. There's lots of demand. It's that there hasn't been much for sale. But now that looks like that's changing.
Does that mean there are more for sale signs popping up?
Yes. I mean, that always happens in the spring to a certain extent. But this year, there are more. February saw 17% more existing homes for sale than a year earlier. And that increase is good for home buyers. For sellers, more competition could mean that they have to be more flexible on price. The last couple of years, there's been concern about the so-called lock-in effect, that homeowners with low interest rates will just never move. But the uptick in listings suggests that as time goes on, people do end up moving. And return to office mandates are also spurring some folks to move closer to cities now that they've got to be in the office several days a week.
Right. Well, what are you hearing from prospective home buyers?
That it can still be really hard to buy a house. You know, a couple days ago, I chatted with Jeremy Mason, who's 40 and he's never owned a home. Even though mortgage rates are pretty high, people like Jeremy are biting the bullet and trying to buy a home anyway. He and his wife have been searching for a year in Fairfield County, Connecticut, and they'd already made 3 offers unsuccessfully.
And it kind of sucks. A few weeks back, we put one in. We were $161,000 over the asking price, and we did not get it.
This week, he and his wife put in another offer. He said if this one didn't work out, they might just stick with renting for now.
I am a little nervous about the new administration, all the various tariffs, what's going to happen, what's not going to happen.
I checked back in with Jeremy yesterday, and they didn't get the house. There were 16 other offers.
Wow, 16. Well, how does that uncertainty that he mentioned affect the market?
Yeah, a lot of folks are worried about the economy. With all these new tariffs happening, it could raise the cost for a lot of things. And if you're worried about losing your job, you might not want to commit to a big mortgage right now. If you're looking to sell a home, you might worry about whether there are going to be buyers for it. Adding to the uncertainty is the cost of home ownership that used to be pretty steady, like home insurance or HOA fees, have skyrocketed in some places. That can make buying a home feel like more of a gamble than it used to.
And there are also some new rules that affect home buying and selling, right? What's changed?
Yeah, that's right. A settlement with the National Association of Realtors went into effect last year. The first big change is that in the past, it was usually assumed that the seller would pay both their agent and the buyer's agent. But now that's no longer a given. The second change is that now buyers who want to work with a real estate agent must sign an agreement that sets the agent's compensation before they can go see any homes. So pretty much the only way to see a home without signing something these days is to go to an open house. Many real estate agents say the system really hasn't changed much, but it certainly adds more things to negotiate in what can already be a tricky process.
NPR's Laurel Walmsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
States around the country say the Trump administration is illegally freezing money that they need from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The Trump administration says the funding is just being reviewed and is not frozen. NPR's Chris Arnold reports that for the states and regular people who need that money on the ground, the uncertainty of when they'll get paid is starting to bite.
Jason Frey and his wife live in California, but they own a condo on Maui. Since the wildfires hit almost 2 years ago, they've been able to offer up their unit to an elderly man who lost his home. FEMA pays the rent. But a couple weeks ago, Frey got an email saying that the rent money will be delayed because of the Trump administration's spending pause.
I mean, it was like DEFCON 1 for us. So yeah, we've been really stressed out about it.
Frey started calling his bank, asking could he get some kind of pause on making his mortgage payments for the condo. The bank said no.
And so we're scrambling to figure out not only that, like, what's going to happen with the survivor. Like, I would love to be able to house him for free, but we just don't have the funds for that. And we would have to, like, start some kind of eviction. And I hate using that word because, like, this is not his fault.
Frey is caught up in a much bigger issue. The Trump administration has held up the flow of federal money across many different agencies while it reviews the spending. 22 states and the District of Columbia sued, saying the trillions of federal dollars were already allocated by Congress. A federal judge then ordered that money to start flowing again. But now the states are telling the judge that, in particular with the FEMA money, the administration is not following his order. Aaron McMahon is the director of the state of Oregon's Department of Emergency Management.
In total, we've got $129 million in federal dollars that are frozen.
McMahon says ever since January, when the freeze started, the state has received no FEMA money whatsoever. But she says FEMA owes Oregon that money for all kinds of disasters and disaster mitigation.
From severe winter storms, flooding, mudslides, landslides, wildfires, and of course, COVID-19.
On top of that, McMahon says a big chunk of the money to pay the salaries of local emergency managers across the state comes from FEMA.
We're not going to be able to pay them in April unless we get the funding from the federal government.
Meanwhile, some Trump administration officials have talked about eliminating FEMA altogether. Is that talk and the frozen salary money is stressing out the people that she oversees working in emergency management.
The uncertainty that this has created with them, with their jobs, is really disruptive, and it's truly disappointing. People are working very hard right now responding to flooding that's occurring in the southern and eastern part of our state. This, quite frankly, is a distraction from what they need to be focused on.
FEMA declined an interview, but in a court filing last week, the Trump administration said that it is complying with the court's injunction. It said the funding is not frozen, it's just being, quote, reviewed for fraud, waste, or abuse, and that FEMA continues to process payments as quickly as possible. It is true that at least some FEMA money is flowing. It's unclear how much and who is getting it. While entire states say that they're not, some groups that work with disaster survivors say that they are starting to get payments. For Jason Frey, who owns that condo on Maui, the company that routes the rent checks from FEMA to him tells NPR that it just got paid. So Frey will get the rent money and be able to pay his mortgage this month.
The relief that we got with that message, yeah, huge relief.
Still, all this is making him wonder about the month after that and whether there'll be ongoing disruptions at FEMA.
You kind of sit there and think, okay, well, you know, they're not going to put fire survivors on the street. But then again, you kind of look at what's happening elsewhere.
Like the Trump administration trying to shut down entire agencies. Frey worries FEMA might be next. As a result, he and his wife are talking about pulling their condo out of the FEMA program. So whether it's Frey and his one condo or the head of emergency management for an entire state, the uncertainty is already causing worry and disruptions. And if more money doesn't start flowing soon, that is sure to get a lot worse. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Tariffs are central to President Donald Trump's economic plans. Now, as markets and manufacturers brace for another round of them, the ripple effects are unclear.
It's simple. If you make your product in America, you will pay no tariffs.
We get reactions from around the world on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In nearly every culture, there's a soup known for its restorative superpowers. NPR has collected the stories behind some soups from around the globe and is sharing recipes.
I think that after I tasted it for the first time, I sort of had this very transformational moment.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Top officials in the Trump administration were meeting today to discuss a TikTok deal. As NPR's Bobby Allen tells us, Amazon has made a last-minute bid, and Trump has set Saturday as a sell date for the popular video app under a federal ban.
It's not noticeable by using the app, but TikTok is technically operating in violation of a law Congress passed requiring the service to sever ties with China. The Trump administration has promised not to enforce the law, while President Trump holds something of a public auction for the hit app. Now, President Trump is set to meet with Vice President J.D. Vance and other advisors to weigh TikTok's options. Software company Oracle, owned by Trump supporter and billionaire Larry Ellison, appears to be leading the pack of bidders. The New York Times reported Amazon has sent in a last-minute TikTok offer. Yet one key hurdle remains, winning the approval of Chinese regulators, who may use TikTok as leverage in tariff negotiations. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
A House Republican proposal to sell some federal public lands is generating swift backlash from environmentalists and even some in the GOP. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports.
House Republicans already inserted language into budget rules that could make it easier to sell federal land. And now, as lawmakers look for more revenue to offset President Trump's tax cuts, the controversy is again heating up, even as specifics of any plan are murky. Republicans from western states where the federal government owns half or more of the land have long tried to wrest control of it in favor of more mining and logging, or lately, home construction. Yet some in the GOP from states where hunting and hiking access is a political force have introduced bipartisan legislation to prevent any sales. This latest budget controversy follows the U.S. Supreme Court declining last fall to hear a challenge by the state of Utah over federal control of land in that state. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
You're listening to NPR News. China has wrapped up military exercises around Taiwan, declaring the two-day drills a success. NPR's John Ruwitch tells us the military says its troops are still on high alert.
China says the exercises were staged as a warning to Taiwan's leader and others on the self-governed island who it says are seeking independence. Beijing considers Taiwan an inseparable part of China. Taiwan's President Lai Ching-te called China a foreign hostile force last month. China's military says the exercises practiced precision strikes, area denial, and blockades. It's the latest in a growing campaign of drills and other Chinese military activity around Taiwan, seen as intimidating the island. The Chinese military also separately conducted live-fire strike drills in the East China Sea between Taiwan and Japan. The State Department said China's military exercises and rhetoric exacerbate tensions and put the region's security and the world's prosperity at risk. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Beijing.
A Central California man faces charges of murder and attempted murder for allegedly opening fire inside a Walgreens store, killing an employee and shooting out a surveillance camera. It happened Monday night in Madera, just north of Fresno. Police say the 30-year-old suspect expressed hatred for large pharmacies like Walgreens. The pharmacy was also closed at the time of the shooting. Police say the suspect did not know the worker who died. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Around the globe, from Tunisia to Thailand, there's one answer to aches in your body or your soul. It's soup. Here in the United States, that might mean a huge bowl of chicken noodle soup, but there is a whole world of healing, restorative soup beyond that, something that Genevieve Villamora knows well. She spent weeks chopping, stirring, and seasoning her way through pot after pot of healing broth, testing recipes from Spain, Kashmir, Jamaica, Georgia, and yes, Tunisia and Thailand to make them work for cooks here in the U.S. It is part of a project along with reporter Vicki Hallett for NPR. And Genevieve is here in the studio with me now. Welcome.
Hi, Juana. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Okay, I have to start by just asking you, what does soup mean to you?
I think to me, the base of any good soup is a really delicious, super flavorful broth. And that was definitely true for the soups that I tested for this Healing Soups project.
Tell me a little bit about the experience of testing these soups. What was it like? Take us behind the scenes a little bit.
It was a fun challenge for someone like me who really loves food and has a broad base of culinary knowledge, but definitely most of these soups were soups I had never heard of before. So where I started for most of them was really just researching the particular soups, looking up any specific unusual ingredients, and then trying to think of how to translate the soup so that cooks here could replicate something close to it at home.
These soups come from all around the world. When you were researching them, did you come across any, I don't know, themes or commonalities that became clear?
Definitely something that I thought a lot about as I began to cook more of the soups was how some of them have actually very few ingredients, and yet they somehow managed to be so deeply flavorful and really nourishing. Like, for example, the goat soup from Kashmir. Mm. It basically just has water, goat, onions, turmeric, fennel seeds, and cardamom. But it cooks for so, so long. And over that span of time, the flavors transform and deepen so much. And you could really taste how rich and fortifying it was.
You know, it really strikes me as I was reading through the recipes that they're so intensely regional. They're full of local ingredients. Can you just tell us about one soup that you found particularly memorable?
So one of my favorites was the Ital Sip from Jamaica. It was vegan, which is not particularly how I eat on my own. And it also did not have any salt at all. And it was so flavorful and really super delicious. But actually, instead of listening to me, you could taste for yourself.
You brought soup. You brought me some soup?
I brought you some soup.
Oh my gosh. I haven't eaten yet. This is so exciting. And you've been making me hungry the whole time that we've been talking. All right. So I've got this bowl of soup in my hand. Just walk me through what is in this bowl. I just have to say, it smells amazing.
So this soup is such a winner because it really builds layers and layers of flavor. So you take a bunch of aromatics like fresh tarragon, fresh thyme, and you blend them with onions, garlic, and ginger, and coconut milk. And then to that you add like a whole garden's worth of vegetables. Yam, chayote, okra, some of my favorite vegetables. And then they kind of just hang out and cook down. And there, of course, there's Scotch bonnet pepper in there well. So it has a nice like kick to
it. Ooh, my favorite. I love a spicy soup and I love Scotch bonnets. Okay, let's try this. This is really lovely. I really like, there's so many vegetables. And this is a vegetarian soup.
Vegan, yeah.
It's vegan, okay. Mm-hmm. A big part of your job, I know, was taking these recipes with ingredients from all over the world, making them accessible to those of us here in the U.S., like me, who might want to try these recipes. Tell us about the process and give us a couple examples of substitutions that you made in order to make these recipes more accessible.
There was a Georgian soup that had as a main ingredient cow hooves, which I figured most people, if they don't live in an agricultural area, can't easily get.
Right.
But I think in most places you can get oxtail, either through an international grocery store, or you can really order it online and have it delivered to your doorstep these days. And oxtail has similar qualities to cow hooves in that they are high in collagen, which breaks down into gelatin, which is what makes the kashi soup from Georgia so nutritious.
If you had to tell us to start with one soup, if we're trying to pick up one of these recipes at home, where would you tell us to start?
I have to say it's no accident that I brought you the Itel sip, because the Itel sip is one of my favorites. It caught me off guard being vegan and totally without salt. And I think that after I tasted it for the first time, I sort of had this very transformational moment, because it made me rethink my whole relationship to salt. As someone who has been in the restaurant industry where salt is very liberally used, It just made me question, like, oh, if something can be this flavorful without salt, what does that mean? Could I just jettison salt out my kitchen window? It was challenging and surprising in all the best ways.
Oh, I love that. Well, I will say thank you to you before I pick this bowl of soup back up. Genevieve Villamora is a writer, restaurateur, and recipe developer. Recipes for the first six soups are at npr.org now, and there are more to come over the weekend. Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for this meal.
Thanks for having me, Juana.
The actor Val Kilmer died yesterday in Los Angeles. He was 65 years old. Kilmer played Jim Morrison, Batman, and dozens of other characters in movies that helped define the 1980s and 90s for Gen X. Kilmer died of pneumonia, his daughter told the Associated Press. He had previously suffered from throat cancer. NPR's Netta Ulubi has our remembrance.
Val Kilmer exploded onto screens in 1984 as a rock star turned spy in the Cold War comedy Top Secret. Audiences swooned for Hollywood's new heartthrob, with his megawatt California grin and a jawline so strong one critic compared it to a stop sign. Soon, Kilmer was going mano a mano with Tom Cruise as competing fighter pilots in the movie Top Gun.
You can be my wingman anytime.
A former star student at Juilliard, Kilmer thought the role of Iceman was a bit beneath him, as he remembered in the autobiographical documentary Val from 2021.
I thought the script was silly and disliked warmongering in film.
That voice does not belong to Val Kilmer. The documentary was narrated by his son Jack. Kilmer started struggling with throat cancer in 2014. You can hear his difficulty speaking when he returned as Iceman in 2022's Top Gun Maverick.
The Navy needs Maverick.
Kilmer was something of a character actor trapped in a leading man's body. He was attracted to complicated roles like rock star Jim Morrison, who he eerily resembled, and played in Oliver Stone's 1991 film, The Doors.
I am the Lizard King. I can do anything.
Less successful were marquee roles in movies like Batman Forever. Kilmer as the Caped Crusader seemed smothered by his heavy costume. In many ways, Kilmer modeled his career after Marlon Brando's. They were similarly intense, often maddening their co-stars and struggling to squeeze their outsized talents into conventional roles. One that Kilmer treasured playing was on stage as Hamlet.
But this tutu solid flesh would melt.
That's archival tape from the documentary Val.
Resolve itself into a dew.
He was a sweet prince and a singular star. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. John Green has written hit young adult novels like The Fault in Our Stars and built a YouTube empire with his brother, Hank. Green's latest book is nonfiction, Everything is Tuberculosis, and it looks at why TB remains such a deadly disease. He talked with Rachel Martin about living with a very different illness, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Do you spend more time in your head or in the world?
It's not a particularly close competition there, Rachel.
Somehow I thought you were going to say that. Say your answer.
I spend more time in my head by a very wide margin.
What's it like in there?
Pretty intense, to be honest with you. A little overwhelming sometimes. But I spend a lot of time in my head, and not all of it is healthy, if I'm honest with you. Like,
well, you've been open about that, about talking about your OCD.
Yeah, I have pretty severe OCD, and so it's well treated, and I work really hard to treat my chronic illness like a chronic illness, but it is a chronic illness, and it is something I live with every day. And there's this great Edna St. Vincent Millay poem I think about all the time, where she says, I think she's writing about depression more than obsessive thoughts, but I think it's the perfect summary of obsessive thoughts. She says, she's writing about a snowstorm, and she says, three flakes, then four appear, then many more. And it's like that with my worries sometimes, mm-hmm. where it's like, you just have a worry that kind of crosses across your bow, and then another one, and then another one, and then many more. Mm-hmm. And it becomes like a snowstorm, just absolutely blinding, impossible to see anything other than the fear. And that's a really difficult, really scary experience, because then it feels like you're not in control of your own thoughts. Like, you're not the captain of the ship of yourself. You're just along for the ride, and somebody else is steering the ship. And that's quite a scary thing to think about your own self.
Is there anything positive about it? Is there anything beneficial about it besides the fact that it is who you are? But
Yeah, it is who I am. I mean, I find it to be mostly downsides, okay. to be honest with you. Mostly bummers. And so it's hard to, of course, I don't know what I would be like without OCD. And so I can't imagine what it would be, but I'm sure I would be different in ways I can't imagine now.
Yeah, it is who you are.
Yeah, I like that way of saying it, but that like there is an upside, but the upside is that it is who I am.
Yeah,
I've never thought of that before.
I have a person dear in my life who suffers from OCD, and it has been instrumental. It has been helpful to learn more about it and to learn how, yes, it is debilitating. It can be debilitating, but it is who this person is.
Yeah.
And this person is wonderful.
And you're worthy of love.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's maybe the only thing we're worthy of, but like, you're worthy of love is exactly as who you are. And so the fact that this is who you are and this is part of who you are means that this is also worthy of love.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. I've never had that before. That's such a gift to me. Thank you.
Find the rest of their chat by searching for Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube or Spotify.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. On Monday evening, Senator Cory Booker began a speech criticizing what he called the grave and urgent threats posed by Trump administration policies. He kept talking through the night into the next day. He did not sit or use the restroom. And after 25 hours and 5 minutes, a new record for a continuous Senate floor speech, Senator Booker yielded the floor last night. Today, Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey joins us on All Things Considered. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I love your show and appreciate being on it.
Senator, I have to ask you, after 25 hours and 5 minutes, what hurts the most today?
Oh, God. The body is weary in a lot of places, from my back to my feet and to my legs. I'm just feeling it. But my soul is soaring, and I feel very blessed by the whole experience.
We'll get into a lot more, but I realize this may not be the most political question to ask you, but I do have to ask, 25 hours, no bathroom break. How?
I did something that I probably should not be recommended, but I stopped eating about 2+ days before, and then I stopped drinking the day before. And so it wasn't great, and it led to some really fun cramps, but that was a prep, basically, that I did.
Wow. Now, Democrats and those who oppose President Trump, they've been crying out for your party to do something, really to do anything to stand up to the president. And following fiery public rhetoric like yours there in the Senate, how do you harness that momentum into substantive, real action?
Well, I really wanted to, as much as possible, and I know that it is what it is, but I tried as much as possible to frame my remarks not about left or right, but right or wrong, and that this was a moral moment. Because a lot of the policies, and I know this from talking to my Republican colleagues, are not widely agreed upon by either side. And, you know, a lot of things that he's doing that he didn't even run on. And the challenges to American people, whose voices I tried to bring into my speech, and read dozens of real Americans from all across the country, especially New Jersey, but on both sides of the political aisle, just really saying that these policies are morally wrong and they're going to hurt people. And so I hope that perhaps this is one of many ignition points that get people to kind of galvanize and come together and stop him from doing a lot of these things, like we did in 2017, when Americans from all backgrounds were able to stop him, along with three Republican senators, from taking away health care from millions of people.
I do want to talk about some of the issues that you brought up. You highlighted a number of issues, among them protecting Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security from possible cuts from the Trump administration. Do Democrats and those who want to protect those programs have a plan to actually do so?
Well, we know the reality right now. They're going to use a budget process that necessitates no Democratic votes. And since they're in the majority, that process means that we do not have the votes as Democrats alone to stop them. But you hear Republicans, a guy like Massey in the House, who has said very boldly, I will not vote for this because it creates trillions of dollars of new budget obligations, just expands the deficit. And I think appealing to the moral and character and, frankly, principles of the other side that they use and they say. And that's why during the speech I brought in so many Republican think tanks, Republican voices, Republican governors. And this cannot be a Democratic-only win that we're looking for. It has to be. The only way to win now is by waking up and engaging with people on both sides of the political aisle and the real reasons to stop this, because it makes no fiscal sense to create trillions of dollars of more obligations for our grandchildren. It makes no sense to take money away from programs like Medicaid, all to give tax cuts that disproportionately go to the wealthiest amongst us. That's, I think, most people's sort of principles that violates.
You mentioned that Democrats can't go it alone. I don't have to tell you, Republicans hold majority control of the House and the Senate. What have you been hearing from your Republican colleagues in the wake of the speech?
You know, I got a lot of hugs from my Republican colleagues. I think people might find that surprising, but a lot of people just appreciated it. I think the fact that it was Strom Thurmond's record bothered my Republican colleagues as well as Democratic colleagues, and they were happy to see me smash that record, even if they didn't agree with all the points I made during my remarks. Others have said to me, you know, there's a lot of things that I said that they can agree with, even though there's things they disagreed with. So I've had an experience in the Senate getting some big bills done by finding common ground. I think this is a time where the party knows how over the top Donald Trump is. The party knows how demeaning and degrading he can be to people in and out of the party. The party knows that there's problematic things, but now we've got to wake them up to actually do something about it. I quoted King last night where he said, what we have to repent for is not the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, just, but the appalling silence and inaction of the good people.
I want to ask you a question, if I can, about your party. Multiple polls show that favorability of the Democratic Party is quite low, and that combined with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's leadership through the government spending bill showdown has led a lot of people to question the direction of the Democratic Party. In your view, what do Democrats need to do to get more people to believe in your party again?
Well, I think we could not talk about the party and start talking about the people. I really think that we have got to start having a bolder vision of who we are as a country, not just about who we're against as the other party. I know we have to fight fights of principle to stop taking away of Medicaid, the undermining of Social Security. That's very important. But a new generation is coming to American politics. Baby boomers are starting to leave their posts and new people are rising. This is an opportunity as a new generation, as new generations, millennials and Gen Z and Gen X. We need to dream America anew and start giving a vision that's compelling, that moves more people to say, you know what, I want to support that. The reality is a lot of people are rightfully feeling like government isn't doing what it should do, that they don't feel inspired, okay. They don't feel a sense of common cause. We have got to provide that.
I just want to get one other thing in here. You mentioned that your speech broke the record of Senator Strom Thurmond, who, as we know, is a vocal segregationist. How does it feel to have broken the record of a man who is well known for his opposition to civil rights?
Well, I feel like it wasn't a personal endeavor because so many people showed up. To see these members of the Congressional Black Caucus, as well as other congresspeople, filling the chamber on the floor, looking into their eyes, I called out to John Lewis, who during that time was fighting for civil rights, being beaten, but we got a chance to serve with him. And so I think the ancestors were with me. I think so many people in spirit were with me. And as a man of faith, I know I wasn't standing there alone. I was being lifted every hour by the energy, by the prayers of a lot of great people, and then by the legacy and strength of our ancestors. So I'm grateful.
We have been talking with Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. Senator, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to